This is Mathematics After Hours.
Oh, hi. Hello. Welcome. Other words of beginning. It's episode 120 of Rack Addicts After Hours, and we are back in Rack Addicts Towers? Rack Addicts Towers. That's what we'll call it. And it's another morning edition. Tea in hand. Caffeination is happening, but I think I am more awake than the last time we did a morning one.
I don't think I am.
No? Oh, no. Dear. We'll see if the audience can notice the difference in tone. Not from last episode, because that was in the pub with different microphones, but from the one before. See if you can hear our morning-ish voices. Who knows?
I would imagine that your vocal cords change shape over the day or something like that.
Most likely. Maybe they relax, depending on what... Who knows?
Maybe they relax when you wake up and then they tense up over the day or the course of the day.
I'm not a vocal cardiologist or something-anologist. I don't know. Not a cardiologist, certainly. But Pete, what have you been up to this past week? Even though I only saw you yesterday, and then before that, only a few days before. But we got catching up to do.
Well, one thing I failed to mention on the last podcast was that I had to make another modular case, which I had mentioned,
indeed,
for Mark, who was over from Bulgaria, aka DJ Caesar, as he is known in the DMB world. And that was a bit of a exciting thing. Mm-hmm. And when I say exciting, not necessarily making a case, but the speed it had to be made.
Last minute panic.
So it is was a 84 HP version of the Scarab.
Gotcha.
With a new power pack, which I've started using.
Yeah.
That seems to be working out.
Awesome.
And had the same wrinkle finish paint.
Oh, yeah. Wrinkle finish. That's a very good name for it. Yeah. Wrinkle finish.
Well, I can't think of any other way of describing it.
Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
But other than that, same fittings, everything like that. And I had 3 days to get it done completely. I actually got it to him into his hands about 2 hours before we were supposed to leave for the airport.
Brilliant.
And we had to load it up with modules and he was going to carry it as hand luggage.
Oh, yeah. Good fun.
He was expecting the usual, because you can imagine putting a modular case through the x-ray machines and they're going to see that and think, what the hell is that?
Did he get any funny looks?
He didn't get asked at all about the modular case.
Yeah.
But what he did get asked about was the urchin. Have you seen the urchin?
The urchin? No.
It's a... I don't know how to describe it. It's like a small metal enclosure with just an output.
Right.
And a power input.
Yes.
And it's got sort of spikes. I think they're mostly steel, and it comes in various sizes. And you must have something like a guitar pickup or something inside with the circuitry, and you sort of pluck the spikes.
Oh, no, I might have seen that before, actually. Is it actually called the urchin?
I believe.
Is that just what he calls it?
I think it is called an urchin. He saw it on Richard Devine's channel.
Yeah.
And he was putting it through the hologram microcosm.
The sound urchin.
Yeah, that's it.
That thing.
Yes.
Amazing.
And they're sort of custom built to order.
Yeah.
So they were very curious about what that was.
Fair enough. Yeah, you can't exactly pack that, can you? You just stab through your clothes.
Well, they're sort of rounded, so they're not... I mean, I wouldn't like to fall on it, put it that way. But they're not that sharp.
Mm.
They've sort of got bobbly, rounded ends on these the sort of small, wiry spikes, if you want to put it in that respect.
Yeah. It kind of looks like it's got eyes with the position of the jacks and switches and stuff.
That may be deliberate.
Quite funny, most likely. Brilliant. So he got home safe and sound.
Yeah, we got it just the nick of time, because there was a lot of disruption at the UK airports, as there has been over the last few weeks. Got a call from him, I think about 24 hours later, when he'd actually managed to get some sleep and so forth, because he was travelling through the night, and said that everything was okay. He actually sent me a picture from the studio, his studio in Sofia, showing me the modular case in place.
Next to the other ones.
Yes. So that was mission complete.
Excellent. A job well done.
Thank you.
So this past week-ish, we've had some adventures in home ownership. I've already put up one blind, which was awful, but...
Well, awful putting it up, or awfully put up?
The results aren't terrible. It is slightly sort of the edge that you don't see as much is quite ragged from having to cut it a few times and getting more and more annoyed each time I had to cut it down further. But no, that looks kind of fine. These blinds are on the UPVC type windows on our balcony. We didn't want curtains because the cats would ascend vertically and then the cats and the curtains would descend suddenly and violently onto the floor. And we didn't want to pay, what did we get quoted? £700?
Ouch.
For its six panes. There's sort of the central door and then to either side and sort of split, so six sections. So we used a company called Blinds to Go. They actually had a brilliant system, and I put up some blinds, and I didn't hate it, and they work. It's amazing. You know those, they're not Venetian blinds at all. They just go up and down, they're on strings, kind of fabric, little wavy fabric. Those things. Those ones, and they go from the top and the bottom. I don't know why I'd want that, but they do. But they work perfectly. You just have to slide these little brackets sort of inside where the seal on the windows
okay.
kind of is. So there's four of those, and you're just going to chunk, and the whole thing just sits on. And they doubled our order without charging us extra. So if the cats do shred them, we've got spares.
You've got replacements.
Yeah. Shh, don't tell Blinds to Go.
Do they fit to the actual windows that open?
Yeah. So
they open with the windows. They don't
exactly.
stay. Okay, they're not in the sort of window frame or in the window jamb.
Yes,
itself.
They're attached to, well, it looks like they're attached to the glass sort of frame part, so they open with the windows and everything. They're very swish.
How do they physically attach? You didn't have to screw into the windows, did you?
No. So those brackets that go into the thing,
okay,
into the bits, there's sort of a frame around that you build that has the blind in it, and then that just kind of clips in. It works. So that was a pleasant surprise not to have miserable headaches. The other thing that I was going to talk about last week, and if you go onto Facebook, you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. I mentioned my night photography escapade has come back from the film lab, and I was slightly disappointed to see star-shaped patterns everywhere on all of the lights in these shots. And I had thought, after talking to my father-ino, who likes his photography, thought, ooh, actually, yeah, maybe it was the lens filter that you had. I have a UV filter and a sky filter on the lenses, mostly just for protection. I thought, well, yeah, that's a good idea. Maybe next time I'll take them off. But I did some more digging on the interwebs, and it turns out when you're shooting long exposures like that at... It's a slow aperture if it's a big number. Anyway, a small hole in the lens. So I was shooting f8, 11, and 16 for all of these. When you have a really tiny hole in your lens, you actually get light diffracting around the sort of slits in the blades of the aperture, which makes those star-shaped patterns, which some people want, and you can. There is a specific type of, sort of starburst filter that you can use to create that effect. But the solution is just to shoot wide open.
I would have thought you'd want to shoot wide open in the dark anyway.
Yeah, you would. Maximum light and all that, and not having 7-minute exposures like I did. But my thought process was, ooh, actually, I've got loads of time anyway. I don't really mind. And let's go for maximum sharpness. There is a bit of noticeable softening at the fastest speeds on the lenses that I've got. So I just thought, yeah, sharpness, that sounds good. So what I'll have to do next time is go for the fastest speeds I got. I think I can go to 3 point something on the wide angle and 1.8 on my 50mm. But then I thought, if I'm using the light meter app on my phone and it suggests a shutter speed I can't do, or because on manual my camera will only go to 1 second, and what have I got? I got one, half, quarter, I don't know. Let's say it's a weird shutter speed that it wants that might not be conducive to accurately doing by a human hand. Thought I might grab some ND filters as well so I can make that shutter speed longer, just so it's more repeatable by silly human me. There we go, that's my film photography update.
You do have to get a lot more hands-on, don't you, with analog photography?
And I'm enjoying it. Hands-on is fun, even if it does take a while. And if you're out with somebody, they will want to leave you behind very quickly.
I suppose it makes you focus very highly on the mechanics of taking the pictures, the detail of the settings, whereas I just blast away with my digital SLR, not really thinking too much about things.
Yeah, it's sort of in the back of my mind, thinking, ooh, actually, not when I was doing the night photography, but in the Lake District, actually, this roll of film did cost me £15. So I would like to make these quite good.
Yeah, so that's predominant, whereas I can just sling a large memory card in and
fire away forever.
Shoot away with impunity.
Mm. Ooh, the other film-related thing, actually, is after getting back from the Lake District and finishing another roll of film, I had five to send off to the lab, and I chucked it in the basket on the website and went, so it's going to be over £50 for the development and scanning of all of those. So I thought to myself, how can I fix this? And it's actually the scanning that really adds to the cost at this point. So I don't think you could develop on your own and send your negatives off for scanning. I'm sure you could, but I think my plan of attack shall be to scan at home and then maybe later develop at home as well. But that would mean £3 or £4 a roll of film just for development costs, and I would save some cash. I did actually pick up a new camera, which is a Canon Demi half-frame camera. So it splits your standard 35mm frame in half vertically. So as you hold the camera landscape mode like you normally would, you actually get portrait pictures, which is interesting. But it means you get 72 portrait pictures instead of 36, which I thought, ooh, that might be quite nice to carry around and take less premeditated shots.
So is it still presenting the whole 35mm frame to the lens, or is it only presenting half that?
Just half. So the normal film advance lever will move the film along half the distance a normal camera would. So yeah, you double your money.
So it's for frugal photographers.
Yes. Unfortunately, most of these cameras are the sort of point-and-shooty equivalent, so they often, well, most of them will just have a selenium light meter, which now won't work because it was from the 60s or whatever, and they're auto modes might not be that easy to use, and not all of them have full manual either. So on this one, you set your film speed, and in theory, you'd just match up a needle with the where the light meter was showing, if it worked. But there's a focus ring on the lens and a bigger ring which sets your shutter speed and aperture at the same time, and you can't decouple them. So I did a roll of Ilford HP5 and just kind of hoped and guessed with my exposures, so we'll see what happens. But yes, that, a bit of a long way round of saying, that one's actually more expensive to get developed and scanned because it's 72 odd photos rather than 36.
Are the developers able to handle that quite easily? They know what they're getting when when they receive your film.
I'm sure if, let's say, you had a black and white film that could be developed in the usual colour products and you could take it to any old high street place and do it back in the day, you might just get back 36 pairs of photos, which I think is how a lot of people scan them, and it's kind of interesting just to see two pictures sat next to each other that aren't related or anything. But yeah, this particular lab, when you select, you go black and white, colour, and then 35mm, 120, 4x5 or whatever. And then in the scan section, you can pick half frame. So they know what they're on about. It's quite a good lab. It's AG Photo Lab from Birmingham. I don't really have much experience to say if they're better or not, but they're very, very fast and about the same price. So that's what I went for.
Fair enough. No photography shops near you?
There is a shop. I'm not going to say its name because then you'll know where I live. Actually, I don't live there anymore, but still. They sell a little bit of film and they develop colour, and I did get a roll of colour done there. And it was kind of fine, I guess.
But not great.
No. They weren't very high resolution, and it was kind of fine. And it took a long time because you have to drop it off on a Wednesday and pick it up the next Wednesday. So if you time it badly, you could be waiting sort of a week and a half for a roll of film.
You're definitely going to have to get to the point where you can develop your own film rolls.
I am quite excited to do that at some point.
I mean, black and white is not too much of a problem. I believe it's the colour that's a bit more tricky.
I think I might have mentioned this before, I can't remember what company it is, they make a product called Monobath, which is literally one solution to do a full black and white develop fix and everything, which is quite cool. And I think the same company does a an easy, in inverted commas, colour development stuff as well. But I think you just need to have good temperature control on the developer, which I think is that's the hard part of doing colour at home, is the temperature. Yes, I think on black and white it's less vital to be right on the money for temperature.
So do you think there is still a big fraternity for analog photography, or has it gone the same way as the steam engine? It's only for specialists and enthusiasts.
It seems pretty alive and well. I did actually fund not quite a Kickstarter, but a pre-order for CineStill 400D. That's a cinema type film stock with the remjet removed. So it's used for still photography.
Remjet?
It is a extra layer in the emulsion that does something specific that film people need. Not film people, but cinematography film people need. I don't know. I'm still a noob. But yeah, there's new film stocks coming out from various manufacturers, and there's a lot of activity in the community online, so it doesn't seem like it's dying.
So do you think they're having a little bit of a renaissance like vinyl?
Definitely. I mean, prices for film cameras are definitely rising, and it's difficult to get hold of film a lot of the time. So yeah. As with many things, I think I've probably jumped in just as things are getting expensive, which is what happened with synthesizers as well. Well, maybe I wasn't so close to missing the boat on that. But yeah, I think it's alive and well and not too niche, this corner of photography.
Well, certainly the photographic shops that I sometimes frequent do tend to have a lot of used equipment for sale.
Yeah.
And a lot of analog photography stuff that just seems to sit in the glass cabinets. Of course, you get the collectors who are purely collecting the camera bodies and things like that, not necessarily to use, but to hoard.
I'm pleased that the, as with any hobby, we've talked about it before, gas will swiftly arrive.
Certainly gas in the photography world.
Oh yeah.
Major gas.
Mine's not too bad at the moment. I'm not too gassy, but I have identified sort of the next camera. In fact, two different sort of next camera directions.
Which are?
One of them is definitely sort of more set in stone and obvious. It's just the last and best of the current series. So I have an Olympus OM10.
Yeah.
And
I remember those.
Yeah. With that series, there's the OM two digits, which were sort of the more consumer ones, and then the OM one digit, which were the slightly more professional ones. So the OM10 is the consumer version of the first camera. And the OM1, which is very popular, is a full manual, I think, with no electronics. Does it have a meter in it? But that was kind of the pro one. So the one I have my eyes set on is the OM4 Ti. Ti being, oh, it's got a titanium body, because why not? But it has a really good metering system in it, a really highly regarded metering system. And it will also do, I think it might go one shutter speed slower and one faster. So it'll do 1/2000th. Or I've only got 1/1000th. But crucially, it'll be fine with both my lenses.
So what sort of date are we talking about? How old are these cameras?
I think that one was produced until the late 80s, maybe.
Okay.
Maybe so, even later, actually. Let me have a quick look.
So possibly 30-year-old camera body.
Oh, no, actually, even I think the OM4 Ti or the OM4T, I think both names existed. That was 1990 and actually discontinued potentially in 2002-ish.
Cool, that's quite a lengthy lifespan, so to speak.
Yeah, it's not too bad.
I couldn't imagine a digital camera this day and age lasting.
No, definitely not.
Up to 12 years.
At the moment, they seem to be living below £500.
Let me
for a body.
Correct that. I don't expect the camera not to last. What I expect is the manufacturer not to sell it for 12 years.
Exactly, to keep it in the catalogue.
They would have a replacement product.
Indeed. So let's see what's on eBay at the moment. Okay, so we've got body and kit lens, £300, body, £215, body and lens, nearly £500. There could be some deals to be had.
Better get in there quick before inflation strikes.
Definitely. And I did say there was another camera that was sort of on the gas list, but it's not quite just a camera. I would like a medium format camera of some kind, because the detail is just amazing in the negatives that I've seen people take. It's mad.
I would assume that the most desirable one would be something like a Hasselblad.
Most likely. I think What else is kind of up there? There's a few Mamiyas that are really popular. The Mamiya 7, I think, is one of them. Slightly more affordable, sort of starting at the £500 mark, is the Pentax 6x7. I think there's quite a few of those, the TLR ones, those kind of two-lens, weird-looking doodads. There's some quite expensive ones of those.
Are there any inherent problems in getting medium-format film processed?
Yeah, I think those will be using sort of 120 film, I think that's what it's called. I assume, let's actually have a look. I'm not going to assume anything. Let's go on to AG Photo Lab's website, shall we? Right, and we can compare some pricing. So let's say we're just doing, I don't know what would be different. I assume because it's bigger, you need different machines if you're using machines, but I really don't know. To the consumer, I'm going to assume it's more expensive, so I'm just going to check. So I'm going C41 color processing, 35mm film with no scans, £3.49. Bargain. Now, if we go 120 film, we have options from 6x4.5cm up to 6x12cm. So the smallest option, £3.49 still. What about the big chunky 6x12cm? Would you look at that? It's still the same price. So let's add some scans.
So what's the dimension of the medium format?
6cm by somewhere from 4.5 to 12.
Somewhere between...
Yeah, it depends on, depends on the camera, because it's just a roll of film, so it'll be 6cm. The actual
height between
thingies,
what they called.
The short side is going to be 6cm, and then the actual frames that get exposed will depend on the camera. I think if it's 6x4.5cm, you might get about 12 shots, and on the really big ones, you might get like 9. I have no idea at all. Okay, 35mm film with the standard scans is £9.49. And if we do 120 film with scans, £9.49. Okay, it seems there's actually not that much cost involved in the actual developing and scanning side. It will just be buying the camera and buying the film. And, well, I suppose since you get less shots per shot, it's more expensive. But per roll of film, there we go. That's my camera update of the week. Now to the next section, which we'll chuck in before the news, I think. Pete, you asked me a question, or suggested something we should talk about a few weeks ago, and I thought, yeah, that's a brilliant idea, but I wanted to do some actual research so I can talk about it a bit more properly. Do you want to introduce us to our topic?
Right. Well, I was having a discussion a few weeks ago with a colleague and also had a very similar discussion sometime later with one of the customers. Mm. And that was in respect to how realistic digital pianos actually sound. I don't get exposed to acoustic pianos generally. I don't have access to one, and I haven't had access to one for many years. So I've got no way of comparing a decent acoustic piano with a digital one. So I've got into the mindset that they sound relatively good, especially the sort of high-end ones where they go to extraordinary lengths to try and generate realism.
Yeah.
But I've now started to doubt that after, as I say, comments from a staff member and a customer who was also a very proficient piano player and involved in the sampling world, let's say.
Yeah.
So I had great respect for the comments he was making, and his suggestion was that they don't sound as that real.
Mm. I thought, when you mentioned this, the Roland LX-708 is a vastly superior experience, but actually, I stopped. And definitely in the case of the sort of portable pianos, definitely nowhere near, really, if you think about it. And that may be because it's a Casio and it's terrible and the samples are really bad. But even if it's the Rolands, which we quite like, there's still something missing with the smaller ones. Normally, it's that kind of resonance and presence that the big ones have. So let's think about the LX-708, because we know it quite well. The flagship of the Roland range, with, you know, big old speaker system and soundboard transducers and all this kind of stuff. Like you, I haven't been exposed to acoustic pianos for quite a while, though I have played some really nice ones in my time, some really nice grands and uprights. Without that side-by-side comparison, it's really difficult to know. But assuming the colleague and the customer are both right, and I don't doubt them for a second, why might they be right? Now, let's say you're a music producer, as I hope many of our audience are. That would mean we're actually talking to the audience we think we are. Anyway, if you've used piano samples, you'll know there are bad ones. Like, some of the Logic built-in pianos are pretty rough, to be honest. And then there's some seriously nice options that you can buy for vast amounts of money. And I think some of the best of the best are pretty much kind of perfect, and I will tell you why. Even if you might make an argument, oh, there's not enough expression in the 127 levels of MIDI or whatever it is, or the 128 levels. Those sample packs and virtual instruments live in a slightly different space. You're not going to be experiencing them as you would expect an acoustic instrument to be. You're likely listening to them through headphones or through really nice speakers, and they're a recording tool. So I think, let's say you have the best piano in the world, mic'd up with the best player in the world, in a studio somewhere, and you're listening to it through headphones, speakers, microphones, that kind of array. You could have that same player play the exact same thing through a MIDI keyboard and that particular amazing plugin, and you would never know the difference. Because of the pipeline and how you're experiencing it, I don't think it matters if it's digital or acoustic. I think the problem becomes when you're actually interfacing with something posing as a piano in the real world. Am I making sense?
Yes, you are.
Excellent.
And it was also suggested by both parties who I had this discussion with that some of the plugins were far superior to the sort of digital, physical pianos that you can purchase.
Now, assuming I'm right, which I may not be, I have no idea, and that the issue lies essentially in the playback system. Let's think about what the playback system, in inverted commas, would be for a real piano. And Roland and Yamaha, and there are various other people who have cottoned on and started going in this direction. Well, with a real piano, you will hear all of the individual strings, all of the strings' effects on other strings because of the mechanics and the physics of vibration and sound and such. You will hear the body of the piano itself vibrating and all the tactile mechanical elements of the keys and the hammers and what have you. You'll experience all of that emanating from the space that those physical elements occupy. With something like the LX708, since that seems to be our guinea pig for this discussion, you'll hear probably very well modelled digital replicas of all of those things coming from a set of speakers. Now, if you think about the soundboard of a grand or an upright piano, you could think of that as one big speaker, but that is one big speaker. It's what's it going to be? Over a couple of meters square on both sides, various dimensions, but well over 2 by 2 meters. Whereas the digital options are going to be a few small ones, some bigger ones, and one massive one for low frequencies, maybe. But they're all points, for want of a better word. It's not a huge entity emitting these sonic vibrations. They are these little a set of points, and I think that is the primary problem. We have such good technology these days that you can physically model all of those weird interactions inside a piano with all the strings affecting each other, but at the end of the day, I think it's how you reproduce that into the real world that's going wrong. There are other manufacturers who seem to think the same way. I did some research to see who was making this kind of stuff, and one option to try and jump over this realism barrier is called the resonance piano. There it is. Ignore the keyboard bit that he's playing on. It's actually just a grand piano-shaped thing with where the keys sit just chopped off. And they've got, as far as I'm aware, a very traditionally constructed small grand piano body and a quite high-tech transducer-based soundboard situation. So what they suggest is, ooh, plug your Nord in front of this thing and use it as a speaker. And from what I can see, it kind of works all right. But then I had another thought. If you have a Nord or any other piano that is just playing samples, and those samples were recorded in a room with mics and such, I think it would be somewhat like using a guitar amp simulator, like a Line 6 Helix or a Kemper or something, which has a cabinet simulation in there, and then playing that through another guitar speaker cabinet. So you're kind of doubling down on your speaker cabinet situation. So I think something like the resonance piano might perform best if the samples that you're playing were recorded in an anechoic chamber or other incredibly dry environment where you're not presenting any room sound. So if you plug a Nord into this thing, I think you're going to be playing room sound through a resonating box into another room, and it might be slightly odd.
Okay.
Undetectably so, probably, to most mere mortals, but it wouldn't be the pinnacle of accuracy. Anyway, I've rambled about it. Those are my thoughts.
So what we're saying is, no matter how you try and achieve this using digital means, there's always going to be some element of the uncanny valley about it.
Yeah, and to some extent, why bother trying? Because if you're making music to sell or to exist in the digital domain, as I've mentioned, just use some of the really good libraries that are out there, because nobody's ever going to know. And when you listen back to it, for all you know, you could have been playing on one of the best pianos in the best rooms in the world. I think, also, if you want to be playing a digital piano in a room, and you're going through all of this effort to try and make a digital piano more realistic, probably thereby more expensive, just get a real piano.
Yes.
But you might say, oh, but I want to play other instruments through it, or I want to have a, you know, that classic bass on one side and piano on the other, because the old people who come into the shop always seem to want that. Well, there is an option for you. This is quite cool. It is... Who is this company? I don't know. Let me quickly have a look. Innovations. Ah, okay, so this is a company that makes pianos. Acoustic pianos, normal pianos, called Steingraber and Zörner.
And Son.
I assume so. Steingraber, not Steinway, but another piano company with Stein in the name. Now, I mentioned they do normal pianos. They also have a tab on their website called Innovations. And there is one called... Ooh, the Mozart Rail. I'm going to have a look at what this is. And also the Sordino, I don't know. But they also have a transducer option, which is pretty cool. This is integrated into the soundboard of your piano and allows you to do some pretty cool things, which are demonstrated very well in a series of videos on that particular web page. You can change the tuning of your piano, change the volume of your piano, and play other instruments through it in quite an interesting way. The videos are definitely worth watching. The guy has a laptop next to him running the software, and he'll go, okay, let me just play this piano. It's an amazing sounding piano. Sounds great. And then he says, ooh, actually, let's put a synth pad under that. And it happens. And it blends so nicely with the piano because it's part of the resonating body that the piano is amplifying itself through. It blends in a really cool way. And then he goes on and says, actually, let's just put some really nice piano samples through it. Now I'm playing microtonal music as well. So there's a few things. He's got, obviously, a MIDI output from the keyboard of the piano and that transducer and the software. And I think that's probably the pinnacle of digital pianoing for realism.
Sort of a hybrid piano.
Ditch the fake digital piano, keep the real stuff, and then add all the extra weird instruments in via a transducer.
And then follows my question, do we have a price on that?
No. Let me have a look. It's one thing that's always annoying about piano companies, high-end ones as well. You go on the website and you go, oh, just because I'm interested, what if I wanted a Steinway Model D? You can't. They won't tell you the price on their website. Don't be stupid. So I don't know.
What's that? If you have to ask, you can't afford it.
One of those, most likely. Yeah. Anyway, I discovered lots of interesting things. So thank you for sending me down that voyage.
Thank you for that bit of research.
Hooray! There was also a really good paper that I read. Probably the first time I've read an academic research paper for fun. I don't regret it. This is Model-Based Digital Pianos from Physics to Sound Synthesis, just talking about the mechanics of piano modelling and all that kind of thing. Super cool. If you want to look that one up, Model-Based Digital Pianos from Physics to Sound Synthesis by Balazs Bank, that's Balazs, and Juliette Chabassier, Chabassier. It's a good read.
Okay.
Hooray!
Bit of great bedtime reading for me, then.
Yeah, no, it is really cool. Do recommend. I think it's synth news time. Pete, lay it on me, because it looks cool.
Yes, I'm actually somewhat interested in this next Ooh. Product. So, Create Audio, who are relatively famous for the Nifty cases.
They didn't do much else, did they?
Not much, no.
Apart from, I think there's a module that's in there, but I'm going to have a look. Yep, pretty much just the case and a couple of modules.
They have released a product called the Nifty Keys, and it's reasonably priced, and I'm actually quite interested.
It does look the business.
So we had the Waldorf modular key.
KB37, that's what it was called.
Sort of case with keys.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have a massive amount of functionality. It was really heavy and really expensive.
Yeah, and not a huge amount of case for your money.
No, but this does seem slightly larger and is substantially less cost involved. It's, what, nearly half the cost of the Waldorf?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's got quite a bit of functionality built in. They've been promoting it quite a bit, and they've distributed them amongst the usual suspects on YouTube. So there are quite a few videos that you can go out and find. I watched the Sonic State, but I believe that a few others have also got them as well. And they are also available immediately in the shop, or certain shops anyway.
Oh, nice.
So we're looking at $599.99 dollars wise, and the same in euros.
Not too bad at all.
So one thing that I thought was a slight drawback, and I have to mention it, is the actual output on the power supply is not all that. It's 1500 milliamps on the plus 12 and 1000 milliamps on the minus 12. Now, from my recent experience with the Scarab case, I had to have at least a minimum of 2,000 milliamps on both buses.
I mean, it's only marginally more. Actually, wait, no. It's 2 HP less than one row of that. So I think that might be okay. That's quite...
2 HP less, that's 104. And
it's
this
112.
Is, yeah, so it's bigger.
104, not 114, my bad. Even so, not a huge amount more than one row.
One row, yes.
So I think it'll be fine, even for some juicy stuff.
If you fill it with Strymon effects.
Yeah, don't do that. It probably won't survive that.
So maybe that'll be okay then for that amount of HP. Other than that, it's got various features in it that I think are quite interesting. I don't recall the Waldorf having that. So there is a sequencer.
Yeah, there was just an arpeggiator in the Waldorf one. Auto chord function. Oh yeah, actually, four voices of polyphonic stuff, or MIDI to CV, four voices of MIDI to CV versus the two on the Waldorfy boy. Ooh, there's a mod wheel which has an LFO behind it as well. That's really cool. Internal clock, audio and MIDI stuff, multiples. It's the real deal. And it's got wooden end cheeks. That's great.
I'm actually thinking that this would make an excellent controller for the Moth.
Big time. Yeah.
I was. As well. Yes. I was contemplating the Matriarch, which I still will grab at some point. But I think in the intervening time, I'm going to grab one of these.
Could it be the beginning of your Q121 piece?
Ooh. Yes, indeed, it could be.
No, it looks really nice. Good stuff, that. Well done, Create Audio. Brilliant. Since, I mean, I was saying before we started the podcast, the Waldorf was a bit niche, just in how many people want a small case just to basically make their own monosynth in for quite a lot more money than just buying a good monosynth. Because this has so much more space in it, I think it's a viable option. And considerably cheaper.
Also, they seem to have designed it slightly better in the respect of the positioning of the power supplies. I noted with the Waldorf, the power supply was very prominent, so if you didn't have any SCIF-friendly modules, you would have trouble inserting them on side of the case.
That is a very good point. I'd forgotten about that, given it's so long since I've seen one. Yeah. Ah, take that, Waldorf. Ooh, do you want to talk about the Jupiter X and the Jupiter XM getting updates?
No.
Oh, this is a fun little headline. So, there's a Eurorack module from Mystic Circuits, which is called iDumb, which lowers the barrier to making IDM. It literally says on the top of the module, instant IDM. So it's a sequencer with a bunch of trigger outputs, and I think it's some control inputs, and it makes your rhythms for you, apparently. That sounds quite fun. Check it out if you like IDM. Oh, there we go. That'll be the end of the synth news, and time to round it off with the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. Oh, that's not an M at the end. How strange. Pete, what have you got this week?
I've got another YouTube recommendation, and it's actually a YouTube channel that I only discovered this morning before I even got out of bed.
Oh, amazing.
I was having a quick perusal on my iPad, and this particular channel dropped into my video queue. And the name of the channel is Floyd Steinberg.
Great name.
So Floyd does a channel relating to his music, a lot of it electronic. He does some hardware reviews and other bits and pieces, sort of short pieces on connectivity or combining certain pieces of equipment. The video that actually popped up this morning, which was the one that caught my eye, was that he was using the Mini Dext, which is a version of the Dext.
I know it.
DX7 soft synth, and he was running it on a Raspberry Pi.
Oh, no way. That's amazing.
That caught my eye because I have a couple of Raspberry Pis which are not actually doing anything, and I think that I shall give this a go.
Nice.
So he was going to implement 8 instances.
8?
Yes.
One's enough.
Well, there was that. I can't remember. Is it the TX816, which were rack mount modular DX7s in a kind of 19-inch rack format, and you had 8 all in one?
Because the DX11 that I had was the keyboard version of the rack version of that.
Okay.
I think. Anyway, yes, cool.
Yeah, so he goes through the whole implementation and how you carry it out. So quite a good, interesting tutorial for that. And a little bit of a technical challenge, which I am going to onboard.
Awesome.
So simply, that is my multimedia recommendation for this week. It is the YouTube channel entitled Floyd Steinberg.
Wonderful. Another YouTube channel for you, one from me, and yes, it is photography related, or cinematography at least. Matthew Stern, M-A-T-H-I-E-U, so I assume it's mature. Matthew, I don't know. Stern, S-T-E-R-N. And his icon is a little pictograph of a lens. So yes, the description of the channel is photography, weird lenses, and more. He just has a bunch of videos, which are 7 strange lenses, 6 weird lenses you've never heard of, 5 weird vintage lens adapters for crazy effects. And he just shows them, and it's really well presented. Nice photography and videography where relevant. There was one, I think I must have come across this after I was Googling around for ND filters and whether filters could produce the starry effect and things. There was one, 12 weird lens filters put to the test. Kaleidoscope filters and starry pattern ones, all sorts. But they're all quite bite-sized and very interesting, including one lens adapter, so it just sat behind your lens with a rotating polarizing filter, and I'd never seen a polarizing filter moved on video before. So obviously taking the reflections off still water, so he was taking some video of like a koi carp pond, you couldn't really see them, and then suddenly the water is crystal clear. And he also did it on some sort of white water waterfall style stuff, and it looked really strange seeing it go from yes, that's white water, to suddenly oh, now it looks calmer. Really odd. But yeah, it's a great channel. Do recommend Matthew Stern. There we are. Thank you so much for tuning in. And hopefully, Rufus, thank you for listening as well. Hope you made it to the end. Great to see you yesterday. Now, farewell. We'll catch you in episode 121. Bye.